Hi, this is the Dark Tangent. And the speeches you're about to listen to were recorded at DEF CON 6, which was held in July 31st to August 2nd, 1998, at the Plaza Hotel and Casino in old downtown Las Vegas. These speeches are copyright, non-commercial use, educational uses only. If you'd like to use them for any other purpose, please contact DEF CON at www.defcon.org or email to dtangent, that's D-T-A-N-G-E-N-T, at defcon.org. Now, some of the speeches were lost, so you're getting what we've got recorded. Now sit back and relax, and here comes some knowledge to your head.
Who the enemy is. Conferences like this certainly prove that. White hat, black hat, gray hat, all those kind of things. The enemy is Ira Winkler. Did he get PSD for that? And it's kind of different. We're going to look back perhaps in the coming years into the good old days, the Cold War, when we knew who the enemy was, and the enemy was the evil empire. But the threat was a little bit different, and the repercussions were certainly going to be different with the threat of thermonuclear annihilation of the planet. And back then, in those days, Gorby and Reagan decided that they were going to try to solve the problem in some novel way, out-of-the-box thinking. How do we avoid going to war? So they met in some isolated city and decided that instead of potentially going to war, they would hold a dogfight. And the winner of the dogfight would take over the planet, and that would be fine. We'd have one unified planet, whether we were the winner or they were the winner. So the Russians went out and brought their best geneticists and engineers and got all the best money out of the Defense Department and built a Jurassic Park-sized dog, drooling with fangs and can chew through 4-inch bars. And the Americans went off and did their thing. When it came time for the dogfight, the Russian dog came out snarling and ready to kill. The Americans had a leash with a dachshund 12 feet long. At the moment when the referee says, fight, the Russian dog tears across the field at the dachshund, and then the dachshund opens up its mouth and clamps shut and eats the Russian dog in one bite. The Americans win the war. That's it. Everything was great. Everybody's happy. But the Russian scientists don't get it. So they go off to the bar to talk. What happened? What went wrong? They couldn't figure it out. The American scientist kind of chuckled a little bit and says, it really wasn't as difficult as it looked. The real trouble, the really hard part, was finding a plastic surgeon that could turn an alligator into a dachshund. We no longer know who the enemy is. And some of the premises upon which security has been made over the last several years, I hope to show you, have been inappropriate. They've not been successful. And we need a new approach to security, which is going to echo more closely that which we're really trying to do today, and that is conduct business. Whether it's business over the internet or business to business and bank to bank or supplier to supplier, it's about business and it's ultimately all about money. But we all need to be talking to each other in order to achieve this. We're also into this issue of fast. How fast can things occur? How can we make things occur just in time? Like Dell, Dell does not bring in 2 months worth of parts to build computers to go out in 2 months. They bring in parts every single day and hope to have them out in 3 days. It's faster, it's more efficient, and they make more money. So we're constantly thinking about time. How fast should a credit card transaction paid on the internet? That's why we have cryptographic accelerators today. Time is becoming increasingly critical when it comes to the performance of the issues of business-to-business transition communications. Now, for those of you like me who have some gray hair, you may remember the good old days when information security was easy. Information security was one direction. It was unidirectional. We had a mainframe off in some glass room, And inside of that room there was a big box, and we had hard wires over dedicated networks, the dumb terminals at the other end. The application sat at the mainframe, and all we had to do was control access to the privileges, rights, files on that particular machine. Fairly easy to do. But today, we have a new concept of security that's required, and it's called symmetrical security. We have to enforce security controls if we're trying to do anything in two directions. Our employees, not only to the internal resources, but to the external resources. What are they allowed to go to? What are they allowed to bring back into their offices? Telecommuters, what are they allowed to do on the outside? What are they allowed to do when they dial into their home networks? Partners, part-timers, consultants. How do we control all of the various types of access that are required in the symmetrical world when the bottom line concern really is all about dollars and cents and making revenues and profits? Now, to understand where we are today, we need to step back about 20 years and look at the concept of where security came from, the kind of security stuff we're talking about today. And it came from the military, the NSA, the DOD, NCSC, that's the National Computer Security Center, began to look at the problems of security, but they were concerned about a different kind of security. These were these single mainframes inside of locked rooms with guards, teenagers with M16s, barbed wire, guarding the contents of them, and all the people that were going into those rooms were already trusted. We already assumed that they were the good guys. And that was the model upon which we began to consider security. We started to do it under the concept of risk avoidance. How do we keep the bad guys out? How do we keep them out of those computers, even though we already trusted the people that are going into those rooms? And they developed a model based upon the concept of fortress mentality. How high can we build the walls around these electronic systems in order to keep the bad guys out? And this would make sense, because this is a concept that the military has been dealing with for thousands of years. We step back to 1300 BC and we had Troy. Now, Troy was not exactly the most successful military operation in history if you were inside the walled city that was protected against 9 years of attack by Odysseus and the Mycenaeans. After 9 years, they walked away, left the horse, and the rest is either mythology or history. It didn't work. The Great Wall of China was erected as a fortress mentality to protect against the marauding Mongolians from the north, to keep them out of China. But it didn't work. There was new technology to defeat it. The catapult defeated the concepts of the Great Wall's fortress mentality. And we all know today that the Great Wall of China is not secure at all, because we've all seen David Copperfield float right through it. The early security models that were developed based upon these concepts was called a reference monitor. And the reference monitor that typically got adopted in most systems that went through these processes was developed by two engineers called Bell and LaPadula, and was a fairly simple model for the kind of environment that they were dealing with, a single processor environment, even though it was multi-user. And what we did is every time there was a system request, the processor would stop at the reference monitor, go over to the lookup table, see if this particular user was permitted to take this action at this time on this day, and if so, fine, he went ahead and did it. The process would continue until the next request came along. If he was not, he would stop, and then the processing would continue. But taking this concept into modern systems where we've got the symmetrical communications, we have very, very complex operating systems where we're not opening a single file. We're opening dozens and perhaps hundreds of associated files that are required to make any particular application work. So in the case of today's systems, the reference monitor, what's going to happen to the effectiveness of today's modern systems and applications if we invoke the reference monitor? What would happen to the speed? Comes to a grinding halt. This guy was almost right. That's very, very slow. And in a networked environment where we have the constant symmetry of communications going back and forth, we don't have enough processing time in the universe to use this kind of model to begin securing using a fortress mentality mindset. So the access control rules that were set by the military for these environments are very, very passe, and we also know not terribly effective just from the kind of work that we are all involved in these days. Over the years, the military kept trying to enforce and build new types of models, new improved security models. And in 1987, November of 87, they came out with what they called the Trusted Network Interpretation, because in 1987, we were all starting to network our companies. So at that point, they said, here is a 400-page book that will tell you why we have no earthly idea how to secure a network. And that was introduced in 87, and there's been many subsequent attempts, none of which have been terribly successful. So the shortcomings of the approaches that we've been taking with fortress mentality are pretty straight ahead. They're designed for standalone systems. They don't work well when we're trying to communicate, when we want the electronic drawbridge down between us so we can make money, exchange information, whatever communications we're trying to achieve. It took forever to evaluate these systems and determine if they were secure or not. And God knows how many companies are putting software out today. They swear it's secure, and what is it? It's not. We cannot evaluate this to the level that we need. The United Kingdom has deployed the world's largest secure network. It's called CHOTS. 55,000 secure terminals rated at the B1 level, distributed all over the United Kingdom. And none of them use it. None of them use it because they're using applications designed in 1986. Don't work today. So what we've learned over the last 30 years is that we're not smart enough as a species to secure a computer. We can't do it. There is no such thing as perfect security. We need to have another approach. What we need is a model that will hopefully be simple, that will give us some utility, and maybe, hopefully, give us some quantitative analysis so we can know exactly how secure we are. Secure to a 4.3, secure to a 6.8. Some method of actually measuring the amount of security we have in our environment. In order to understand how to do this, we're going to step back to about 100 years to Jesse James, and he was a great train robber. And he would rob the train. And why would he rob the train? What did he want off the train? Money, okay. And how would he get the money? He'd roll the safe off the train. Now the train goes away. Jesse James is sitting on the side of the track with the safe. Let me ask you, are the contents of that safe secure? No, why not? Because he could blow it up. Who is the safe secure from? Who is it secure from? Why is it done? It's secure from the good guys. Not from the bad guys. It's secure from the good guys. So what are we trying to do here? Let's fast forward to 1998. That's my personal Y2K solution up there. And what we've got now is a big bank in a big city today. And inside that bank is a great chandelier, and there's marble floors and great panoramic windows around the city. And what is in the middle of a typical big bank that looks like that? What sits in the middle of that room? A vault. A vault. Now, this vault door weighs 13 tons. It has 3-foot pinions on it. It's surrounded all the way around with reinforced concrete. And inside of it are negotiable securities and Krugerrands and cash and all sorts of other good stuff. In this environment, is the contents of that vault secure? Who said no? Who said no to that? Why is it not secure? It's got vulnerabilities. And what vulnerabilities are that? Well, how do we know exactly what those vulnerabilities are? What? Some point they have to go in and out. Let's say it's still closed. Let's say it's not going to get open. What's the vulnerability? It's unusable if you don't open it, exactly. But we have something else that the manufacturers of these vaults give us. They rate the performance of their safes. They rated in oxyacetylene temperature and time, how long that vault is protected against 3,200 degrees centigrade, or against how much power, how much explosive power it takes to break through the walls or the vault door. They give us a quantitative measurement by which to begin our security efforts. Now, is that vault the only thing that we use to protect the contents of that safe? Is that, no, you're shaking your head no. What else do we have? got dumb guys with guns. What else do we have? You have time box. What else? What? Alarms. We have alarms. We have bad guy sensing alarms and oxyacetylene torch alarms and heat sensors and motion sensors, depending upon how much we're really trying to protect the contents of that bowl. But we have one other thing as well. What do we have? What'd you say? Dumb guy with gun? There's our dumb guy with gun. And hopefully the dumb guy with gun is going to come running every time the alarms go off. But now we have the elements we need to hopefully take this model, something that exists in the physical world, and move it over into the virtual world, the cyber world, the electronic world. And what we're going to do now is only talk about time. Nothing else but time. And we're going to assume that we've got the equivalent, a logical, virtual equivalent of a vault, and it's maybe a firewall or some password protection system or something that is surrounding our intellectual assets or electronic assets that we're trying to protect. But we don't know exactly. We don't know how strong that is. We don't know if it's certified to Microsoft C2 strength or not. Well, hopefully it's not. But what we're going to do, as we do in the case of Microsoft C2 and T, is we're going to assume that this value, P, protection, measured in time, the sub T, we're going to assume for the next few minutes that that equals zero, that we have no effective protection, as is true with most C2 Microsoft systems that are actually plugged into the wall. Now, the next element, alarms. We're going to add the second element called DT, detection. And we're going to start measuring and thinking about detection systems as a function of time. How long does it take a detection system to actually work? Now, who's in this room that will actually admit being a systems administrator? Okay, gentleman in the black shirt. In your network, whatever company you have, I don't want product names or your company names, I don't care about any of those details. Do you have an intrusion detection system, some sort of detection system in your network at all? You do? Okay. Now, when something goes wrong for those things that you're trying to find out, the anomalies, about how long does it take for your intrusion detection system to take? A wild guess is fine. Any number that I can make fun of you with is perfectly adequate. Days? What bank do you work for? All right. 5 minutes. I like that answer. All right. It takes 5 minutes in this gentleman's network to detect that something that you're trying to detect anomalous has gone wrong. So it is created a detection. But now we need to add the equivalent of the dumb guy with gun, and we're going to have a reaction system. So I'm assuming that you're going to be paged in some way, shape, or form. Is that correct? And are you paged on a cell phone, on a beeper? How are you paged? You're paged on a PCS phone. So from the time that the detection system has found something anomalous, how long then does it take you to get notified? About 20 seconds. So we're at 5 minutes and 20 seconds now. From the time that you are notified, how long does it take you to get to wherever you need to be to solve the problem? It depends entirely upon what? If you're in the bathroom. So right now we're back to the days issue, aren't we? Okay. So let's say you're in the office on a regular day. About how long would it take you to get to where you got to be and do something about it? Another couple days? Couple minutes, all right. So we are now at 7 minutes and 20 seconds. The total of D, the detection time, which you said is 5 minutes, and the reaction time, which is now 2 minutes and 20 seconds, for patient to you and for you to get over and do something about it. In your network, assuming that you have no protection whatsoever, assume you have none, and this kind of, some event is occurring, somebody is inside of your naked networks, how much damage can they do in 7 minutes and 20 seconds? They can toast the whole thing. That was a technical term I wasn't going to repeat up here. All right, so they can toast the whole thing in 7 minutes and 20 seconds. Okay. In what amount of time could they not toast the whole thing? A couple seconds for a scripted event. So in a scripted attack, you're down to, let's just use rounders, let's say 5 seconds for a scripted attack for them to get through the system. So what is the object here? What is his goal at this point? Because he's using Microsoft C2NT, I'm presuming. And some other, we're assuming protection of zero at this point for argument's sake. What do you really want to achieve now? What would, do you think would be the goal to help make your content, your intellectual electronic assets, better protected? What would help you the most? Okay, so you're saying either increase the detection time, and decrease the detection time, decrease the reaction time so something can happen faster, automate the response so it happens faster, and or add better protection that we're assuming to be zero because a trusting and protected product has historically not been the smartest move, as most of us know in this room. The formula to begin looking at the security of your networks is this. Very, very simple concept. If the amount of time that you are offered by a particular protective device, whether it's a firewall, password, anything else, doesn't matter, is greater than the amount of time it takes you to detect and react to an anomaly, you then can say you have security. You can't exactly say how much because we still don't know and never really will know absolutely how strong that P is. But the goal then, if we look at the formula backwards, is we increase the effective amount of protection we have across our electronic assets if we decrease the amount of time it takes to detect and react to any particular anomaly coming along. Now, in the physical world, we have this. We already have these kinds of models. We have physical detection models that are very well timed. We have physical reaction models that are very well timed. We understand them, assuming the cops aren't eating donuts in the bottom of the Hotel Philadelphia in New York. Maybe they'll respond to something through an ADT type of mechanism, one of the companies that actually does this in the physical world. So adopting this model to the electronic world is going to be the goal. But we need to go through a couple more steps to really understand what we're trying to do here and be able to get upper management to understand, to contribute perhaps more budgetary dollars to the security effort and let it translate so they understand it. So under the auspice, again, we have no protection whatsoever. And we assume that we're naked during that time. We add together the detection time and the reaction time to end up with what we call maximum exposure time. And this is the worst case analysis based upon the very quantifiable and very measurable amount of time it takes to both detect an anomaly and react to the anomaly, whether it's in a manual form or in an automatic form. Next thing that has to be done through an organization, and they hate this with a purple passion, is they have to start to understand where the data is. Where's the goodies? Where's the critical stuff? Where's the stuff that's going to put you out of business? And where's the stuff that you really don't care about? In some cases, most companies don't know. They don't know where the stuff is. And part of the exercise that we need to go through with them is to help them to isolate the real goodies from the not-so-necessarily strong goodies to make our job of implementing the appropriate amount of protection, detection, and reaction so it makes sense. Protection ultimately is going to come last. We first want to understand how fast is our detection system, how fast is our reaction system, and we want to understand the exposure time that we're given. With the bean counters of the world, and with the risk analysis people in organizations, they can help translate this into actual hard dollars of risk, and this ties together the security model and risk analysis model, and only then can we begin to start applying appropriate amounts of detection. And what we're going to find is, in some cases, you don't need any detection, any protection whatsoever. It's meaningless. Maybe the assets just aren't worth protecting at all. In other cases, the assets are do or die. If you get a hold of them, we're out of business. And the answer that many companies refuse to accept is, take it off the network. It doesn't belong there at all. Put it back in the file cabinets on paper and totally mitigate the risk altogether. Now, time-based security can be applied in numbers of current technologies with encryption, for example, ignoring the component of key management, assuming that we've got just an encrypted message. The amount of protection time is that which would take the brute force attack or known cryptanalytical attack against a particular algorithm. And the D value in this case is the amount of time that that information has any value whatsoever. So the issue of using 4,096-bit crypto codes to protect an electronic transaction that's good for 125 milliseconds is certainly open for question, notwithstanding what we're doing with the key management schemes. In time-based security with identification and authentication, very, very simple. The maximum window amount of time it should take to complete an authentication is the amount of protection that we're offered. And then it's the amount of time it takes to actually do it. We need to measure that. Again, we have a real physical parallel for this with people that go to offices or on your home security system. You open the door when the alarm is set. You got to run like heck to the closet to enter in the correct code. Otherwise, the cops come to the door because they think you're trying to break in. The same kind of model works in identification and authentication systems that would have an internal phase clock feedback mechanism. The model can be applied to any type of protective device whatsoever. All we want to do is trigger a clock at the beginning of the identification process or at any sort of access control or other protective process. We have some sort of predetermined amount of time that we deem to be acceptable for that process to take place, and if the process takes longer, then we take a reaction. Whatever that reaction may be, that's going to be your policy. That's your corporate policy, is the one reaction you take. If the amount of time is done underneath the predicted amount, then everything goes along swimmingly. Same thing works with access control mechanisms. Same identical process, but generally, we're talking a lot quicker than with a manual identification and authentication procedure. Now sometimes, like we see the bad guys do this in the movie, they're going to go after trying to break the alarm system, if you will. Now in this case of this gentleman, he's paged over a PCS phone, and if I know his phone number in advance because I'm going to attack his network, maybe I will first attack his telephone system, get him unable to receive the page, and then I have more time by which to do whatever I'm trying to do inside of this network. I'm increasing the value of R in that case. So in that case, perhaps he would want to consider adding some additional protection level across, in this case, his telephone system that he's trying to receive the calls on. So the protecting of the reaction system has to occur through whatever mechanisms are available. In some cases, it could be cryptographic encapsulation if we're concerned with confidentiality or integrity. Or we may choose to use out-of-band communications. One of the inherent problems we have with certain types of attacks these days is it ties up the same hunk of wire that's doing both information transfer and protocol and control signals. They're on the same wire. Oftentimes, we need to go out-of-band, create another communications channel for the control signals to decrease the amount of time it actually takes to react under certain types of attacks. The same thing occurs with detection systems or the alarms that we see or the terror of defusing of bombs. Do you clip the yellow wire? Do you clip the blue wire? Well, how do you do this? Again, adding a layer of protection, just like the bomb makers do right now. They add several layers of protection on top of all the circuits, and they employ the military concept of defense in depth so that the bomb defusers cannot get and defuse the bomb. Now, sequential time-based security says in a large enterprise, I'm not going to know all of my inputs and outputs and ingresses and egresses. Can't keep track of them all. Absolutely no way. So we may want to put time-based security components in various places around the network. We may want to then start measuring from the manufacturers how long this actually takes. Because until the manufacturers start telling us how long it takes, until they start doing some specifications, how are we going to be able to actually implement these systems? Currently, there are several manufacturers in the intrusion detection world and auditing world that are looking at coming up with sets of specifications to provide us with a benchmark of performance to be able to start gauging exactly how long it's going to take, at least for the detection component at this point, which will give us another gauge on where we're going. And ultimately, once we start detecting these types of things, we want to have a reaction system. And again, whether we're going to do it on the same hunk of wire that all of our data is transferring, or do we create a separate reaction channel, whether it's out of band or not, we are going to need to have some additional mechanism that is going to be in itself, by its very existence, an additional layer of protection outside of the physical wiring, the physical communication channel that we're currently using today. in sequential time-based security, we have several layers of sequential barriers with these clocks built into them. Each barrier provides an additional amount of time against the intruder, and if you get through various ones, then the amount of time decreases, and ultimately we're going to be stuck with the amount of time all the way at the goodie box that we're trying to protect. But this does give us the increased amounts of protection by adding time components throughout the detection and reaction system. Now, we're talking a lot more than just straight IP intrusion or anything coming out from the internet. There's a lot of other things that, from an internal security standpoint, will address the insiders of an organization in addition to the outsiders who we may be worrying about. And we want to look at normal system and network performances that can cause non-human caused types of events that could be very harmful to our system. So we want to tie into our OpenView and Tivoli systems and receive a reaction signal coming out of them. Host-based audit systems, many of them operate in real time, and they as well can give us the behavioral characteristics of the users. Are they within the parameters that we accept, or are they outside of those parameters? If they're outside, get into the reaction channel so we understand that something is going wrong and we can take some action against the insiders. We need to do contents analysis to start understanding what information is going in and out that is inappropriate. Again, same type of behavior has to be determined through policy. There's numbers of different types of things that we're going to want to be able to start monitoring, create a detection mechanism that is measurable, quantifiable, and then feed it into the reaction channel that ultimately will take care of the problem, whether it's human or automatic. In the denial of service issues, this is exemplified by having to go out of band under certain types of attacks, under massive spams or huge amounts of pinging going on or flooding the channels. We need to have out-of-band communication. In this particular case, if we have enough cooperation between the various ISPs and communications providers up and down throughout the net, we can actually start tracing back to the source of what's going on, employing the time-based security model by going out-of-band, ignoring the primary communications channel, and determine who's at the back end of it very, very quickly. Ultimately, you as security managers are going to have to create reaction matrices based upon certain types of events. Your policy is going to have to say, what reaction do you want to take? What step do you want to do? Well, you all want to call Monica, I know that. These have to be decided. Managers today are not going through the exercises, the security exercises required to understand what step this gentleman needs to be able to take care of in a very, very quick manner in order to decrease the amount of detection and reaction time in order to help the networks altogether. Ultimately, you guys have to be empowered. You have to be empowered, ultimately, to shut down the networks in certain cases. You want to consider doing this on an automatic basis, determining whether you want to lean towards false positives or lean towards false negatives. This, again, is a policy drive that has to be determined. And you need to be able to come up with plans for graceful degradation that can be automated. Sacrifice the pawn in order to save the king, ultimately. Time-based security allows us to take care of calculating the actual values of the information assets we're trying to protect and determine how much effort we should put into each one of the stages of the information assets in our networks. So ultimately, going through the time-based security process is very different than just going up and putting up a firewall. It's about business. It's about business continuity. And there's some very simple steps that need to be done that are normally not performed in most organizations because we tend to look at security as being a technology problem and not as a process problem, a business problem that is quantifiable. And once we're able to start quantifying these types of things, we can end up with a model that allows the manufacturers to provide us with products that we can hold them to. We can hold their feet to the fire. Either it works or it doesn't work under certain benchmark laboratory conditions. It's quantifiable. We need to be able to tie into the risk analysis people because those are the guys with the purse strings in the organizations who are going to say to the CFO, yes, give them another $1 million to go out and protect the assets. It's absolutely worth it. And the empowerment is absolutely required at your level, and the participation is required at the vendor level to be able to make time-based security ultimately work. This is a very high-level overview of something we've been working on for the last year, year and a half or so. A lot of feedback from some wonderful people throughout the entire community on all sides of it. and I'm anxious to hear your comments and thoughts on it. Either I'm happy to answer your questions up here or out in the back. So thank you very much. I appreciate your time. You've been very kind, and if I can answer some questions, I'll be happy to. Thank you very much. Any questions at all? Or am I off the hook? Yes, sir. I'm hearing the question being with scripts that go very fast and detection that goes very fast, how do you increase the response time? But I'm okay, so the scripting is... So those are almost contradictory questions I'm hearing. You're asking about how to handle, because the scripts are so fast that are going on, and this is exactly the point. Is that the detection systems that are out there today operate at some given speed. I don't know what that speed is today. I'm talking the numbers of manufacturers, and we're hearing guesstimates, but we're just starting to move forward in this concept. The goal is going to be to decrease detection time as much as humanly possible, to make them very, very fast. And part of the process is to get the clock started as soon as certain types of activities begin. And these clocks may be set and reset over and over and over again, several thousands or millions of times per second, based upon the types of feeds that are coming in on a content analysis. And that's what a lot of the IDS kind of guys are doing already. The key to the whole thing, ultimately, is going to be automatic responses based upon policy and initiating those as quickly as possible. There is no such thing as perfect security, period. There is no such thing as perfect security. And time-based security is not perfect in any way, shape, or form. What it does is attempt to quantitatively mitigate, reduce the amount of damage that can be caused. And if our exposure time is down to, if you're saying a couple of seconds, yes, damage can occur, but how much damage? Would you rather have 2 seconds of damage or 7 minutes and 20 seconds of damage? And there is a significant advantage to that. And that's the state of the art today. How that's going to progress, that's going to be up to the vendors, and I don't know. Any other questions? Yes, sir. It is difficult. Security is very difficult. Now, the question is, how do you really find out what's going on? And again, we have to go back to the issue of detection systems and vendors and looking at the different types of behavior. If we said, I'm only going to worry about IP attacks or the IDS stuff, we might be not doing our jobs entirely correctly. What about the host-based behavioral auditing systems that are heuristic, based upon the performance of what your normal behavior on that network is, based upon the access control rules that hopefully you have somewhat distributed across your network, and attempted violations of those. Give us another piece of the equation. As content filtering becomes more prevalent and more feasible to implement, we're going to have another piece of that. We have traffic analysis to be able to do. There's lots of different pieces. No one of them is perfect. Adding them all together helps. But there is no panacea. Again, we're trying to mitigate the damage and mitigate the risk by putting the proper detection and response pieces around the network as a supplement to whatever protective devices you have, because those clearly do not work today. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
How is industry improving the IP, you know, the IP protocol, but all traffic is easier, you know, to look at more authentication of packet bounds, you know,
The question is, how is IP traffic, what's the future of the IP kind of stuff? And the authentication, some of the security. IP6 is supposed to have a lot more stuff in it. I think we're still a little ways away from that. And it's not necessarily going to be a total automatic overnight conversion of the entire infrastructure to IP6 either. So we're going to have some piecemeal. And again, one of the things that we try to do in any risk analysis is examine it from the worst case scenario and then hope for the best. Again, we have to go back to the issue of time. And if time components are able through any of the IP6 efforts to help there, great. We have not looked at IP6 as a time-based component yet. Anything else? Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Good night. See you later.